The Tolkien Road, Episode 245, The War of the Jewels. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 245. Greta, what's up?
Hey. Not a whole lot. Not okay. A whole lot. What's up with you?
I'm just waiting for something to happen with you.
Yeah, with me?
Yeah. One of these days, something's going to happen.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess something will happen.
Yeah.
Right now, I know we're all really enjoying watching some college baseball.
Yeah.
That's always fun.
Yeah, it's kind of a niche. Probably not a lot of people out there watch college baseball, but we do.
But
we like baseball.
Baseball
a lot.
Because it's really good baseball.
Word. You tell them.
Yeah. And it's, you know, people that are, it's guys that are playing because they love the game.
Mm.
Not because they're making millions of dollars.
So boom.
They play harder.
A lot of them have a prospect of making millions of dollars.
A lot of them have a prospect. And a lot of them are probably on scholarship.
Yeah.
But still,
for the love
know.
Of the game.
That's still a big part of it. I think it's probably a big part of it for major league players too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to stop talking now.
All good. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, you're welcome. I realized that I hadn't thought that out very well when I started saying it. So
it's all good. No one pays attention to it anyway.
That's actually
they're
probably
all just like, all right, get on a Tolkien.
They're just like fast-forwarding through this anyway.
Yeah, they're like fast-forwarding the little circle on, mm-hmm. on most phones now.
Exactly. Skip 15 seconds. Yeah.
Just automatic. It's just automatic now. But we got you this time. We're going to keep going. We're just going to keep rambling. No, I'm just kidding. On this episode, we're continuing our journey through the History of Middle-Earth series as we survey Volume 11, The War of the Jewels.
Oh, are the jewels the Silmarils?
That's right, they are. What other jewels of worth fighting over are there?
Well,
there is the Arkenstone.
I was going to say there's the Arkenstone.
Yeah.
That's a big one. And also, isn't there like a really pretty like thing that Galadriel wore?
Oh, well, there's probably, yeah, there, I mean, there's more. Like, yeah. Sorry.
But I understand what you're saying. The Silmarils are probably the king of the jewels.
Mm.
Or the queen of the jewels is what I should say.
The kings and queens of the jewels. Mm. The queens.
I was just trying to figure out how to combine those two words, and you did it before me. Good job.
Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout-out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Lise Yu, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous. And a shout-out to longtime patron James for making his pledge an annualized pledge. So thank you very much, James.
Yeah.
I hereby dub James, a.k.a. Just James, because that's all he gives his name as, is he doesn't give a last name or a last initial or anything like that. So
We've
got some other Jameses who are patrons, so I just want to make sure to distinguish. So he's Just James.
Just James.
Right.
That works.
To distinguish from James the Just, who is like a one of the apostles or an early Christian writer. So... yeah, there you go.
All right.
So, Just James.
Just James.
Thanks, Just
Thank
James.
Thank you. Yes.
You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks, like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. Check it out now to learn more about all the exciting perks we offer. And don't forget, you can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free.
Good deal.
Boom.
Mm-hmm.
All right. iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Leaving us a 5-star rating and a review helps get the word out about us. So need you all to give us a boost over there. Help us out with a 5-star rating, just like we got from Lango82. I think I'm saying that. I think that's an L and not an I. Sometimes I can't tell. Lango, it's either Lango82 or Iango82. Lango82 sounds more likely, but never know. This was left on May 31st, and it is titled Excellent. Love it.
All right. I like that.
Most deaf. Mm-hmm. And here is what Lango82 had to say. I really enjoy this trip through Middle-earth, all about the lore, and I love Greta's role as a foil and non-geek Tolkien fan, unlike the rest of us. The subject matter is tackled briskly but thoroughly and has excellent sites and references. Nice, easygoing style, you guys. Brilliant. Thank you.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Thank you for the brilliant review, Lango82.
Yes, thank you very much.
And y'all need to get busy. If you haven't left an awesome 5-star review like Lango82 just did, you need to be like Lango82 and make it happen.
Please. Right? Yes.
Time now.
Do it.
All right. It's time for the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all those watching us on YouTube. All right. You ready for this, Greta?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. 3, 2, 1. Whoopsh. There we go. There you go. Make sure you get in camera. There you go.
There we go.
All right. You too can be a part of the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5. Just head on over to YouTube where this episode is posted. And while you're at it, subscribe and click the notify bell for our channel. And hey, maybe high five us back in the comments. Just a text high five back would be cool. Mm-hmm. Wanted to read a quick comment. I think I'm going to start maybe reading a comment or two from YouTube early before all the rest of the correspondence. But this one is from Adam H here. And I got to open my email. I had it closed out for some reason. Such an idiot. Gosh. All right. Here we go.
Air five to your forehead.
That wasn't air
five. Oh, it wasn't an air five. Not bad. That was an actual five.
You can call that an air five if you'd like.
Okay.
This is from Adam H. over on YouTube in response to episode 244. Last episode. Adam says, "Hey guys, appreciate your work. Your overview of the history of Middle-earth has been very helpful in giving context to the work in relation to the chronology of the Legendarium and Tolkien's creation and writing of it. I purchased The Complete History of Middle-earth, all 12 volumes, a few months ago, and your series is a handy companion as I start to read them. Keep up the good work."
Oh, nice.
Awesome. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, thank you.
Really appreciate your kind words, and I'm glad to hear it's helping out. So, you know, it's been a good bit of work. It's not the most easy thing to tackle for sure on a mm-hmm. podcast and feel like mm-hmm. you're doing it justice. So I appreciate the kind words and I'm glad that it's helping you and hopefully others as well. All right. Don't forget, you can also check out the rest of our video library on YouTube, which is already large and growing weekly. And by the way, we are sitting at, I think it was 620 subscribers is the latest number. And we want to get to 1,000 as quickly as possible. So need to accelerate that. So if you're listening, hey, if you want to keep listening, if you want to keep listening via podcast, that's cool. I very much was always a podcasting person, but I've been doing YouTube more and more myself. But just know, very simple thing you can do. Just head on over there, subscribe to us, give us a boost. And you don't have to necessarily, we're going to keep posting podcasts and all that kind of stuff, but give us that boost over there. It's a really easy thing to do. And we'll get us closer to those 1,000 subscribers and, you know, doing more cool stuff. And eventually you're going to want to see us over there anyway. So just do it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence and Tolkien news. All right, Greta.
All right.
Let's declare war on War of the Jewels, shall we?
Oh. I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I declare war.
You're about to say, what is The Office?
I actually don't know what I was about to say.
Remember The Office when Steve Carell's like, I declare bankruptcy.
Yes, that's what it was.
I heard the intonation in your voice when he just walks into the room. He's broke and he's like, I declare bankruptcy. Is it? That's all you have to do is you just walk in somewhere and declare bankruptcy, and you're good.
Yeah, I know. Declare is a funny word.
Yeah,
because I feel like you can use it in like it really. You can use it in so many ways, and it's really your intonation and maybe your accent.
Because mm-hmm.
you know, I feel like it's used a lot, like in Gone with the Wind. You know, mm. like, oh, Miss Scarlet, I do declare.
Yeah,
like that, and then it could just be like the Michael Scott version, and then it can also be, you know, like putting someone in their place too. So. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word. So let's declare,
you declare
war.
You declare it's a good word.
I declare right. that declare is a good word.
Sounds about right. All righty. In this episode, we're surveying War of the Jewels, which is the 11th volume of the History of Middle-earth series. This volume was published in 1994. In the foreword, Christopher calls the War of the Jewels a companion to and a continuation of Morgoth's Ring, which we surveyed mm-hmm. on the last episode.
Okay.
So what does that mean? Whereas Morgoth's Ring generally focused on Tolkien's post-Lord of the Ring work on the chronologically latter Valinorian Tales of the First Age. I'm sorry. How did that happen? I could have sworn I wrote earlier there. Chronologically earlier Valinorian Tales of the First Age. This volume looks at the chronologically latter Beleriand-centric tales. More on these matters in just a moment. So the War of the Jewels consists of 5 parts. Part 1 is entitled The Grey Annals. Part 2 is titled The Later Quintus Silmarillion. Part 3 is titled The Wanderings of Húrin and Other Writings Not Forming Part of the Quintus Silmarillion. And Part 4 is titled Quendi and Eldar. All right. So as with past episodes in this series, we'll
Wait,
give it...
you just said five parts, and that was only four.
Oh, shoot. That must have been left over from last time. Four parts.
I wonder if anybody's even still listening to us.
Nix that. Four parts. By five, I meant four.
He meant five minus one.
Five minus one. Come on. You should know that by now. Mm-hmm. All right. So as with past episodes in this series, we'll give a brief overview of each part and look at some highlights, starting with Christopher's foreword.
Okay.
All right. Christopher begins the foreword as follows. The War of the Jewels is a companion to and continuation of Morgoth's Ring, Volume 10 in the History of Middle-earth. As I explained in that book, the two together contain virtually all of my father's narrative writing on the subject of the Elder Days and the years after the Lord of the Rings, but the division into two is made transversely, between the first part of the Silmarillion, The Legends of Aman, and the second, The Legends of Beleriand. I use the term Silmarillion, of course, in a very wide sense. This, though potentially confusing, is imposed by the extremely complex relationship of the different works, especially but not only that of the Quaintus Silmarillion and the Annals, and my father himself employed the name in this way. The division of the whole corpus into two parts is indeed a natural one. The Great Sea divides them. The title of this second part, The War of the Jewels, is an expression that my father often used of the last 6 centuries of the First Age. The history of Beleriand after the return of Morgoth to Middle-earth, and the coming of the Noldor until its end. In the foreword to Morgoth's Ring, I emphasized the distinction between the first period of writing that followed in the early 1950s, the actual completion of The Lord of the Rings, and the later work that followed its publication. In this book also, therefore, two distinct phases are documented. All right, so all that is to say... a few things to note. The War of the Jewels was generally the way the Elder Tolkien referred to the Beleriand-centric period of the Silmarillion writings, right?
Okay.
And then divided by the Great Sea. I like that way of looking at it. We can think of this period as literally being divided by the Great Sea, the big body of water that separates the east from the west in with regard to most maps of Middle-earth. Or as of the earlier period as the Legends of Aman, and the latter period as the Legends of Beleriand. Okay.
So we did the Legends of Aman in the last episode.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. And so Legends of Aman are the one, you know, the ones that have to do with the creation of the Silmarils, the darkening of Valinor, and those sorts of things. Or and even just like the early, very, very early history after Ainulindale and the Valar come to come to Arda and start creating the world, right? So those are the Legends of Aman. They have much more to do with the Valar. The Legends of Beleriand are much more focused on the Noldor and the Teleri and eventually men, right?
Gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeesh. All right. Húrin, Christopher also makes an interesting note about Húrin and the role that the tale, the Children of Húrin, that kind of general legend plays, or played in Tolkien's mind. He said this, for this, It seems to me that an important element was the centrality that my father accorded to the story of Húrin and Morwen and their children, Túrin Túrinbar and Nienor Niniel. This became for him, I believe, the dominant and absorbing story of the end of the Elder Days, in which complexity of motive and character, trapped in the mysterious workings of Morgoth's curse, sets it altogether apart. He never finally achieved important passages of Túrin's life. But he extended the great saga, as he justly called it, into the wanderings of Húrin, following the old story that Húrin was released by Morgoth from his imprisonment in Angband after the deaths of his children, and went first to the ruined halls of Nargothrond. The dominance of the underlying theme led to a new story, a new dimension to the ruin that Húrin's release would bring. His catastrophic entry into the land of the people of Haleth, the forest of Brethil. So, the takeaway there is Christopher's speculation that a good bit of his father's grander intention for his father's intention for the Legend of Húrin, right? All this kind of makes me think, and we're going to see more of this as we go through this book. It makes me think that when we get around to doing another series, which may not be for a little while because this has been a pretty long one, but when we do, we'll need to focus on the Children of Húrin, which of course is one of the books that's been published in the last, I guess it's about, actually, I guess it's a little over 10 years old now, maybe closer to 15. But even so, pretty, you know, one of the more recent works that's been published under Tolkien's name, and one that I certainly do intend to get to. But now I think we have kind of an expanded scope for how we handle that, because there are so many writings of a developmental nature that attach to that. So we'll have to make sure we pay attention to those now that we're educated. So,
yeah.
All right. Looking back now, 17 years on the published Silmarillion, so from 1977 to 1994 when this book was published, Christopher also has a very few interesting things to say. To quote, "The Silmarillion, again in the widest sense, is very evidently a literary entity of a singular nature. I would say that it can only be defined in terms of its history, and that history is with this book, largely completed. It is indeed the only completion possible, because it was always in progress. The published work is not in any way a completion, but a construction devised out of the existing materials. Those materials are now made available, save only in a few details and in the matter of Turin, just mentioned, and with them a criticism of the constructed Silmarillion becomes possible. I shall not enter into that question, although it will be apparent in this book that there are aspects of the work that I view with regret." So that's really interesting, because we see that Christopher does not consider the Silmarillion as we have it, right? The 1977 Silmarillion, to be a completion of his father's work, right? He views it, he doesn't intend to view it as a completion, but rather a construction, right? Mm-hmm. From what we have, right? From all the material that we have. And he also has regrets. You know, he also has many regrets, and I think we said this at the beginning of this series on the history of Middle-earth, this whole series, from really starting with Unfinished Tales all the way through maybe even to the publication of The Children of Húrin and Beren and Lúthien and The Fall of Gondolin, is a reflection of Christopher's regret that his father never actually completed the Silmarillion in the scope that he wanted to, right? I think it's clear from especially this episode and the last episode that Tolkien, he never gave up the dream until maybe he just was so old that he realized he wasn't going to be able to see it. But, you know, he still held on to that dream that he was going to get the Silmarillion, published at some point, and maybe even more books, and started to think about, well, maybe if I just told The Children of Húrin as a standalone tale, or if I told Beren and Lúthien as a standalone tale, maybe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so many tales that he could have told, right? He could have done expanded versions of all of these.
Well, he did. Didn't they do? The Children of Húrin and Beren
and
Lúthien,
but not in a completed published. So, you know, distinguishing between that term completed and construction, right? Completed would be Tolkien completes it and is happy with, you know, it's kind of like, I bless this as my completed version of this.
Like he
achieved with Lord of the Rings in his own lifetime.
Gotcha,
right?
gotcha, yeah.
Otherwise, it's somebody else coming along and trying to do a construction of it.
I see.
Right.
Putting pieces together that were left, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just found those comments by Christopher very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it sheds a little light on his mindset, you know, as he did all of this. And maybe why he went about, you know, we speculated the different paths he could have gone down with his father's legendarium at the beginning of this series. And you know, he could have gone down the path of hiring other people to complete, you know, to complete these stories and kind of fill in the blanks and do their best. Or he could go the road he chose to go, which was, I'm going to basically do, you know, show you everything, right?
Yeah.
It's anything that's worth showing you that I deem worth showing you from everything my father wrote, and kind of try to explain all of this stuff in a textual history manner. So, and that's what we got. So
makes me sad a little bit. Yeah. You can think about how much time and energy and all the things that he poured into these things, you know, into all this, and to, you know, and to have regrets and to not feel them complete.
Right.
I'm sure he doesn't see it as a waste, but
you're referring to J.R.R. Tolkien.
I am.
The elder. Yeah.
Yes, I'm referring to the elder. Yeah. But you know, I mean, we can only do so much with the time we're given. So.
Indeed. And it makes me think, you know, we've talked about how Leif by Nagel was written as the spontaneous kind of response to his anxiety about completing Lord of the Rings, but I guess you could also see it as a anxiety later on in life about the Silmarillion, right? And the parallel is definitely there. And so to be sure, maybe the story is much more appropriate to think about in terms of the Silmarillion, right? That mm-hmm. this was actually something that he never actually completed because of all the things that came along in life, right? And he was always, you know, he was always answering letters and that kind of thing. And like, mm-hmm. it really mattered to him to give good answers to letters, you know, especially if somebody wrote a letter that was, you know, a little, you know, that had more to it. He tended to be very, you know, generous in writing those responses, yeah. you know, which yeah. is cool because that's, we got a lot of, you know, we got a lot of the letters we do have because of that. But it's also, so, you know, you kind of think about that with Parrish, right? Mm-hmm. Parrish always like being like, hey, could you, I wanted to bug you about, you know, help, could you help me out here? There's, you know, there's a little bit of an analogy there, it
Absolutely.
Seems too.
So, yeah, definitely.
One last thing about the foreword. This is kind of cool. So as our listeners may remember, we are expecting a new volume of Tolkien's writings later this year, edited by Carl F. Hofstetter. Well, Mr. Hofstetter receives two shout-outs from Christopher towards the end of this volume. Mm. So apparently, Mr. Hofstetter has been at it for quite some time, right, with the Tolkien scholarship. So I won't go into the details because they're pretty academic, especially for me, who's not really the philological type. But they're, you know, they are interesting. And I will just say that given the substance and obvious attention to detail that Hofstetter exhibited and that Christopher notes, it's clear that he seems to be a good choice to carry the editorial mantle for the next posthumous publication of Tolkien's writings.
When is that coming out?
Actually, it's coming out September 2nd. So it is due on September 2nd. I just pre-ordered my copy today. So
nice.
Pretty excited.
That
so
is exciting.
You can go pre-order your copy of The Nature of Middle-earth by J.R.R. Tolkien, edited by Carl F. Hofstetter. So
it's going to be good.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's look at the various parts. Part 1 is the Grey Annals. The Grey Annals could also be titled the Annals of Beleriand. Like the Annals of Valinor or the Annals of Aman, it is a timetable of the major events that take place from the hiding of Valinor to the end of the First Age. Of the development of this text, Christopher says,
dun, dun, dun.
The history of the Annals of Beleriand began about 1930 when my father wrote the latest version, the earliest version, together with that of the Annals of Valinor. Excuse me.
Struggling.
Yeah, struggling. These were printed in Volume 4, The Shaping of Middle-earth. I remarked there that the Annals began, perhaps, in parallel with the Quenta as a convenient way of driving abreast and keeping track of the different elements in the ever more complex narrative web. Second versions of both sets of Annals were composed later in the 1930s, as part of a group of texts comprising also the Lammas, or Account of Tongues, a new version of the Ainu Lindale in the central work of the time, a new version of the Silmarillion proper, the unfinished Quenta Silmarillion. These second versions, together with the other texts of that period, were printed in Volume 5, The Lost Road and Other Writings, under the titles The Later Annals of Valinor and The Later Annals of Beleriand. When my father turned again in the early 50s to the matter of the elder days after the completion of The Lord of the Rings, he began new work on the Annals by taking up the Annals of Valinor and Annals of Beleriand manuscripts from some 15 years earlier and using them as vehicles for revision and new writing. In the case of the Annals of Valinor, correction of the old text was limited to the opening Annals and the beginnings of a new version written on the blank verso pages of this manuscript likewise petered out very quickly, so that there was no need to take much account of the preliminary words. In Annals of Beleriand from the 30s, on the other hand, the preparatory stages were much more extensive and substantial. So that's what we get here with the Grey Annals, all right? With these later writings, we are starting to see the various threads of development more closely approach what we know. Earlier volumes included similar timetables, and these became the basis for Tolkien's later revisions. All right, to be sure, because the focus is geography-based, the Grey Annals actually extend back a good way and overlap with the Annals of Aman. So, you know, the very first thing that we find here, the very first record, is Valianir 1050, which you'll recall from the last episode is pretty, actually in the first half of the Valian kind of period. And it says, hither it is said at this time came Melian the Maia from Valinor, when Varda made the great stars. In this time the Quindi awoke by Quivianin, as is told in the Chronicle of Amon. So that's the very first record in these Annals of Beleriand. So there's an overlap between the Annals of Valinor and the Annals of Beleriand. And so we see that there's kind of, it, in Christopher's mind, or in Tolkien's mind, it's almost like the, you know, the issue of geography when it comes to these annals. Like, where is the main action of all of this taking place? Okay. We also get several paragraph accounts of events like the building of Menegroth, the coming of the Noldor, Beren and Luthien, and many, many more. So here's a taste, for example, from the year 455 of the First Age, entitled The Fell Year. Here came an end of peace and mirth. In the winter, at the year's beginning, Morgoth unloosed at last his long-gathered strength, and he sought now to break with one great blow the leaguer of Angband, and to overthrow the Noldor and destroy Beleriand utterly. The battle began suddenly on the night of midwinter, and fell first and most heavily upon the sons of Fenrod. This is named the Dagor Bragollach, the Battle of Sudden Flame. Rivers of fire ran down from Thangorodrim, and Glaurung, father of dragons, came forth in his full might. The green plains of Ardgallen were burned up and became a drear desert without growing thing, and thereafter they were called Anfoglith, the Gasping Dust. So that's just a little taste, and you know, there's a lot more. It's a pretty meaty section for sure. But very interesting. Again, I love the laying it out in terms of like years and giving this analytic version of these stories we already know. And, you know, for me, it just, again, makes me think like, man, it really would have been helpful like to have a timetable in the Silmarillion. I think that would have helped so many people to get into it, amongst other things that might have helped as well. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you're just like, you know, what year is it? Right. To quote Twin Peaks. So, nice. Or you're like, you know, what's going, like how much time has elapsed over here? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think this is one that, you know, is a pretty cool chapter. There's a lot of interesting stuff in here. It's another way of seeing the stories of the Silmarillion. And, you know, and from it, we get a brief and general account of events. I will say though, because there's something that comes a little later in this book, towards the end of this book, that made me think when I described this, the annals, as being like the Appendix B in Lord of the Rings, that's actually not quite accurate. The annals are actually like, they're like paragraphs about each year, right? So it's almost like there is a narrative quality to it. It's just told in sort of a chronicalistic fashion, an annalistic fashion, but with a timetable in Appendix B, the tale of years, it's like 1 year and there's like maybe two or three events and it's like maybe two sentences, maybe three sentences, you know, that's like on the extreme end. But with these, you get several paragraphs for, you know, many of the years. So there's something that's a little longer than just like a basic chronology about these annals. So just to note.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Part two is the later Quaintus Silmarillion. In this section, we get a narrative account that parallels the events of the Grey Annals.
So narrative as opposed to analytic.
Right. We don't get like years marking when things are going on. We just get, you know, basically a narrative version. Again, it comes off more like a synopsis than like going way into detail on each thing. But it's still, you know, it's got a little bit more of a narrative quality to it, I guess you could say. So of this section, Christopher says,
dun, dun, dun.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In part two, I shall trace the development of the Quaintus Silmarillion in the years following the completion of The Lord of the Rings from the point reached in volume 10. But the history now becomes, for the most part, decidedly simpler. Much of the development can be conveyed by recording individually all the significant changes made to Quaintus Silmarillion. So, you know, the first part, the Grey Annals, is much meatier than what we get in the later Quaintus Silmarillion in this volume, okay? It's a pretty short section as far as the history of Middle-earth goes, but one thing that really stands out are the maps of Beleriand that are included here.
Nice.
I didn't do a thorough comparison between these and the versions published in the Silmarillion, but I will note that we actually get to see the location of Angband depicted, along with some other notes that I don't recall seeing on the included map. So, yeah, you know, you get you get a little glimpse of Angband, which, you know, it always puzzled me why in the Silmarillion, with the Silmarillion map of Beleriand, it doesn't actually show Angband, right? It just kind of stops at that northern point and you never see it. But in here, you actually see Angband. So you see it depicted, I guess, how maybe Tolkien depicted it in his mind's eye. So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
But yeah, so I like that.
Yeah.
We get to see the family trees and genealogies and what appear to be close to their finished forms as well. So this is a pretty visual chapter. So if you're the type that's like, show me a picture, this is the chapter for you of the entire of the entire series.
If I could just gotten like a picture book version of the history of Middle Earth.
Right.
Sign me up.
There you go. All right.
Well, I mean, I like words too, but.
That's something for a t-shirt. I like words too.
I like words too, but pictures are my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's cool.
Yeah.
That's neat that those are included.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Part three is the wanderings of Húrin and other writings not forming part of the Quaintus Silmarillion. This section is divided into five subsections. The wanderings of Húrin, Elfwine and Dyrhaval, Maeglin of the Ents and Eagles, and the Tale of Years.
I think I want to focus on of the Ents and Eagles.
I figure most people probably do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go through them each individually, though. The Wanderings of Húrin. It appears that this is, in fact, a continuation of the Grey Annals, which were cut short in the middle of the Tale of Túrin. Again, start to look forward to a deep dive into the Children of Húrin and all its glory. So, one thing to note, going back to the Grey Annals in Part 1, is that they actually kind of stop in the middle of the Tale of Túrin, right? They just cut off, so it doesn't get all the way to the War of Wrath, which is kind of a disappointment. But Christopher, one of the big problems he deals with in this book is what was his father trying to do with the story of Húrin? Because it seemed like he was trying to make it a very central kind of thing for the last part of the First Age, right? So that's one of the puzzles that he's left with, and I think maybe one of the answers to it is the fact that we have this book now, The Children of Húrin, and you know, it obviously played such an important role in the Legendarium. So he spends some more time kind of wondering about this and looking at some other writings that seem to pick up where the Grey Annals left off. The second subsection here is Elfwine and Dyrhaval. This appears to be a frame narrative for the telling of the Children of Húrin. So again, Tolkien loved his frame narratives, apparently. Here's a little snippet. Here begins that tale which Elfwine made from the Húrinian, which is the longest of all the lays of Beleriand now held in memory in Eressëa. But it is said there that, though made in Elvish speech and using much Elvish lore, especially of Doriath, this lay was the work of a mannish poet, Dyrhaval, who lived at the Havens in the days of Eärendil, and there gathered all the tidings and lore that he could of the house of Hador, whether among men or elves, remnants and fugitives of Dor Lomond, of Nargothrond, or of Doriath. So, a little frame there. This is Elfwine relating what he'd heard from the mannish poet Dyrhaval. So, there you go. Or via the mannish poet Dyrhaval. Subsection 3 is Maeglin. It essentially traces some notes on the development of this chapter from the Silmarillion we know as of Maeglin, right? The one about the elf who is a, like, he's the descendant of Aeol, and I always forget the name of the mother. Shame on me. But one of the, basically a princess of Gondolin, right? And of course Aeol was the like dark elf who lived in the woods and was kind of creepy, right? And then Maeglin is their son. He comes to Gondolin, and he plays an important role in the fall of Gondolin.
That's right.
So it's been a little while since we've visited that tale, but this is interesting and especially helpful in that it makes reference to the map to me. It's not a particularly long chapter, but it just kind of gives the development of that. Yeah, that chapter, which honestly can seem like it's a little bit kind of just shows up in the middle of the Silmarillion with all the rest of the events going on. It's not completely out of place, but it's a little diversion. And it maybe doesn't get enough acknowledgement as its own little story, you know, and all things. But anyway, subsection 4 is of the Ents and Eagles. And I know, like Greta, you all are licking your chops for this one. but it's actually a very short section. Hmm. And it's focused on the development of the references to Ents and Eagles that we know from the Silmarillion chapter 2 of Aule and Yavanna, right?
Oh, so that's it?
Yeah, that's kind of all we really get there. It's literally 2 pages in here, right? So I know we're all wanting, like, you know, much more lore about Ents and Eagles. And I think there's some little, you know, little tiny little jewels and nuggets in there for us to, you know, maybe deep dive into later, but it's not the, you know, it's not a ton. It's not like big essays on the significance of Ents and all the different possibilities of where they came from or anything like that, unfortunately. So, yeah, I wish it was longer too, but that's it. All right.
Then we can get.
That's right. And then finally, for part 3, the Tale of Years. Of this document, which reflects a very short chronology more similar to what we think of with Lord of the Rings Appendix B, Christopher only gives us those years that pick up where the Grey Annals leave off. Basically, 100 years from the birth of Eärendil to the final defeat of Morgoth. So, taking a look at this here, we'll just read some of these. Read some of these events, but I put down... Oh, there we go. There we go. Yeah, 500, birth of Eärendil and Gondolin. 501, making of the Nauglamir. Thingol quarrels with the dwarves. 502, the dwarves invade Doriath. Thingol is slain and his realm ended. Melian returns to Valinor. Beren destroys the dwarf host at Rothloriel. And then jumping forwards to the year 597, Maedhros and Maglor, last surviving sons of Feanor, seize the Silmarils. Maedhros perishes. The Silmarils are lost in fire and sea. And then 600, the elves and the fathers of men depart from Middle-earth and pass over sea. Here ends the first age of the children of Iluvatar. Hmm. There you go.
All right.
All right. And then part 4 is entitled Quendi and Eldar. And this is a section that will be of much interest to the philologically minded. All right. There's been a few chapters like this throughout. If you're really into the philology, to the study of languages, this is a chapter for you. Tolkien gave this preamble to this particular work. To the elder Tolkien here. Inquiry into the origins of the elvish names for elves and their varieties, clans, and divisions, with appendices on their names for the other incarnates, men, dwarves, and orcs, and on their analysis of their own language, Quenya, with a note on the language of the Valar. So, so maybe, you know, and actually I will say, even though it's probably of primary interest to the philologically minded, there's some kind of interesting stuff in here, even for those who aren't real into, you know, the roots of words and like the subtle variations and what they mean, right? One thing, sorry, I lost my place. All right. Some of it looks, so here's an example, right, of something that's kind of interesting. And this is from the several paragraphs that deal with the elvish names for men and dwarves. And this actually is some of the, what it says about the dwarves here. A little taste. The petty dwarves. The Eldar did not at first recognize these as incarnates, for they seldom caught sight of them in clear light. They only became aware of their existence indeed when they attacked the Eldar by stealth at night, or if they caught them alone in wild places. The Eldar therefore thought that they were a kind of cunning two-legged animals living in caves, and they called them Levain Tadael, or simply Tadael, and they hunted them. But after the Eldar had made the acquaintances of the Nauglim, the Tadael were recognized as a variety of dwarves and were left alone. There were then few of them surviving, and they were very wary and too fearful to attack any elf, unless their hiding places were approached too nearly. The Sindar gave them the names Nogotheg, Dwarflet, or Nogoth, Nogoth Neban, Petty Dwarf. The great dwarves despised the petty dwarves, who were, it is said, the descendants of dwarves who had left or been driven out from the communities, being deformed or undersized or slothful and rebellious. But they still acknowledged their kinship and resented any injuries done to them. So it's like, you know, hey, nobody picks on my younger brother but me, right?
Exactly.
Indeed, it was one of their grievances against the Eldar that they had hunted and slain their lesser kin, who had settled in Beleriand before the elves came there. This grievance was set aside when treaties were made between the dwarves and the Sindar in consideration of the plea that the petty dwarves had never declared themselves to the Eldar, nor presented any claims to land or habitations, but had at once attacked the newcomers in darkness and ambush. But the grievance still smoldered, as was later seen in the case of Mime, the only petty dwarf who played a memorable part in the annals of Beleriand. So there you have it. Some like kind of interesting, you know, bits about like dwarf anthropology, I guess you could say, or dwarf thropology, for lack of a better term. Hmm. Anyway, I find that stuff pretty interesting. I mean, that's kind of stuff that I'm, you know, I kind of get into and, you know, look forward to being in the nature of Middle Earth, actually. So, all right. I think there's some interesting stuff in there to dive into, Greta, but we'll save that, obviously, for the future. Many, many things perhaps to discuss in future episodes.
Yeah.
So, 11 volumes down, one to go.
One. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, there wasn't much for you to respond to on that, you know, in that material.
I know. I feel like I didn't say a whole lot. But
that's all right. That's all right. Well, you got it. You got your opportunity now because it's time for news and correspondence.
I like news and correspondence.
All right. Well, you know, we haven't talked about a lot of news recently, but this I saw this on the OneRing.net, and I found it very interesting. So the headline is Amazon acquires more Middle Earth with MGM purchase. Jeff Bezos steps down to focus on studio and apparently to go into space, because I saw today that Jeff Bezos is like going, he's got his own, like, you know, rocket company, like go, you know, go to space.
Oh, really?
Company.
I thought he was going with Elon Musk.
No. He's got his own separate company, but apparently he's going in July. He's going to go on a suborbital flight. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So putting his money where his mouth is, I guess.
I guess so.
So, or his rear end where his money is. So
I didn't get that.
Putting his rear end where his money is, right? He's going into like,
oh, that is his money's in space. No,
he's got money invested in this thing.
Oh. See, I didn't know any of that.
Well, I just said that he's got his own space company.
Yep, you did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, you're
I'm struggling, it's all good. Too.
It's all good.
But let's
it's a little late. We're recording a little later in the day here, people. So, hey, lay off. Quit judging us, all right?
We're doing our best.
All right. Hobbits are now Hobbits are now owned by Amazon, joining all-encompassing TV rights to the Lord of the Rings book and appendices rights. That's the subtitle, if you will.
Oh, okay.
So they say it's official. Amazon has acquired MGM Studios, including the longtime film and TV rights to The Hobbit and characters related. So what this, I guess basically they own the film rights to The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
Like the Peter Jackson movies?
I guess so. Yeah. Or the rights or
the
something, right?
So they can make their own movies.
So what
now,
this basically means is now Amazon has all of the rights, right, for Middle Earth things.
So we could have hobbits in
that's
the series.
That's what the OneRing.net says, wow. Right? So they basically go from that news to saying what this means is that Latron Prime could put hobbits in their second age show, since rights to that class of characters were held by MGM.
Yes, but timelines.
Reading the article.
Hobbits. No, but I had that exact same thought though. I was like, but hobbits weren't around in the second age.
Yeah. So here's what they say. Amazon needs an everyman entry point for casual viewers. Hobbits are that. There have been rumors that Harfoots are in the show. Remember, they're a type of hobbit, right? A book sourced compromise from the troublesome hobbit rights. Amazon can now change all the dialogue and reshoots to call them hobbits. Casual fans will want that familiarity. So this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah,
you know, it's crazy how much money Amazon is spending on this thing. You know, when you think about it, right?
It just keeps
growing. Obviously, there were more reasons for them to buy MGM. MGM has a lot of pretty interesting intellectual properties that Amazon now owns the rights to. But this is a particularly interesting. You can kind of see the synergy where they're like, oh yes, we should buy this. So anyway, I don't know. I mean,
I
feel like the hobbits weren't
think.
Around. It's like Tolkien himself seemed to say like.
Yeah.
The hobbits weren't around.
Yeah.
So kind of maybe they want to use it as a frame, maybe a frame narrative. I could get on board with that.
Okay.
I don't know though about like if anybody knows anything out there that contradicts the idea that hobbits weren't around, just were not around. No, Harfoots, Stores, or the third variation, that none of them were around, right? In the Second Age, if you know something that says they were around or potentially were around or Tolkien thought maybe they were and we just didn't know about them, I'd love to hear that, but I don't know. This is the kind of fiddling with Tolkien's legendarium that I'm not real positive on. Anyway, I'll link to the article. It's interesting. And thanks to the OneRing.net for posting the news and providing some fun speculation to talk about.
Yeah.
All right, correspondence time. We have an email from Marilyn the Librarian. This one was sent on May 26th, so it's actually going back a little in time. And the subject of this is Gollum and seasoning.
And seasoning.
Marilyn says, I hope that subject line doesn't evoke anything unpleasant. Thanks. It's a funny mental image. I'm like, is this seasoning that Gollum puts on, like, the, you know, on the fish?
Right. That's what I was wondering. Or, yeah. I had a picture of Chef Gollum, like, you know, careful.
Or on the orcs is precious.
Oh, yes. That too.
He doesn't seem to like the, you know, because he, like, complains about that Sam's, like, ruining the
yes,
conies. Yes,
that's right. Yeah.
All right. Continue with Marilyn's letter. I felt it worth noting that in letter 246, Tolkien actually envisions what might have happened had Sam not disrupted Gollum's near repentance at the entrance of Shelob's lair. He says that not even Gollum's newfound love for a worthy master could wholly overcome the power of the ring's domination over him, and so he would eventually wrest it from Frodo. But possession satisfied, I think he then would have sacrificed himself for Frodo's sake and have voluntarily cast himself into the fiery abyss. That's Tolkien's words right there. There's more there, and I encourage you to read it. It's very moving. Letter 181 also has some moving writing about the whole climax of the ring's destruction. Thanks for pointing those out. That's always a very interesting topic. I mean, I just love talking about Gollum, you know, as rotten as he is. But
yeah, he's such a complicated villain.
Well, it's amazing how, like, somebody who's just so rotten, like, you come to feel sympathy for him over the course of the story.
He's a very sympathetic character,
which makes him such a great character.
Mm-hmm. You know? Those are the best kind. Those complicated.
They really
ones.
Are, aren't
you
they?
You can't decide, you know, whether you love them or hate them or rooting for them or
both.
Against them.
You want them to, like, change and become good. You know, you're just like, oh.
Yeah.
You just want to see some little glimpse of good and redemption in them. Mm. She says, I love Greta's image of Tolkien seasoning his text through successive drafts. So that's where the seasoning part of Gollum and seasoning comes from.
Cool.
Tolkien felt that the scouring of the Shire was an essential part of the whole tale. It was necessary to show evil of Sauron's magnitude had affected everyone, whether or not they had actually been involved in any fighting. I can't find the reference at the moment, but I'm confident them recalling that more or less correctly. Perhaps some other listener will be able to chime in on this. To me, it would be weird if it weren't in there, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree.
And she goes on, and yes, some of the crossed out titles of Bilbo's book, which you read from the early draft, were retained in the final text. Yeah, you know, I guess I just forgot, maybe the way they were written and the history of Middle-earth made them stand out more to me or something like that, or just being able to consider them or looking for a highlight from this. So maybe it wasn't as cool a highlight as I thought. But the ones that she actually quotes from The Lord of the Rings, My Diary, My Unexpected Journey, There and Back Again, and What Happened After, Adventures of Five Hobbits, The Tale of the Great Ring, compiled by Bilbo Baggins from his own observations and the accounts of his friends, What We Did in the War of the Ring. And then here's Bilbo's hand ended and Frodo, here's where Bilbo's hand ended and Frodo had written The Downfall of the Lord of the Rings and The Return of the King, as seen by the little people, being the memoirs of Bilbo and Frodo of the Shire, supplemented by the accounts of their friends and the learning of the wise, together with extracts from books of lore translated by Bilbo and Rivendell. So,
awesome.
That's what I'm talking about. That's my kind of title right there.
Agreed. Yep.
Well, thank you, Marilyn.
Yes.
Always good hearing from you. Next up, we have some comments left on TolkienRoad.com on various posts. The first is from Mitch on May 27th. This has to do with sports or games in Middle Earth. So Mitch actually responds at first to Jennifer's comment about Doctor Who that we read a couple episodes ago. And then he says, any sports or games other than golf exist in Middle Earth? And I was just kind of thinking about it a little bit, and I cannot think of any... you know, that are mentioned. There must be. I mean, I feel like even in, like, medieval times, you know, they, like, the sports were the things were kind of the, like, you know, when we're not actually fighting a war, we're going to see who's good at the things that constitute fighting a war. So I have to believe that, like, in Gondor, you know, there were like sports, like
fencing.
Yes. Like those kinds of sports are like, charging full speed on a horse and,
like,
you know,
polo,
like,
or something like that.
Or jousting kind of, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. And then I feel like the Hobbits must, like, had to have had games. I can't think of any off the top of my head,
they're
but
too playful.
They're just too playful. They had to have had, like, games and, you know, and those sorts of things. Well, I mean, we got the Riddles, and now it comes to mind, Riddles in the Dark, right? Mm-hmm. That would be an excellent example of a game, and it's apparent because they both, like, both Gollum, who is, you know, who is a hobbit, and Bilbo, who's a hobbit, both are like, riddles. Let's play riddles, right? So,
That's true. That's fun.
Yeah, so there you go. So, but any listeners out there, let us know. What do you think? Maybe leave a comment on YouTube or send us a note for next time. Let us know if you can think of any sports or games references from any of the works of Middle Earth.
I think they definitely, the hobbits would have had dance-offs.
Dance-offs?
Dance-offs.
Yeah, I can see that.
I don't see how they couldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like there was always music and movement, so, you know. Or like square dances.
Yeah.
Things like that. Well,
yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I can totally see that.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question to ponder, though.
Absolutely. Thanks for asking it, Mitch, and hopefully we get some good responses to that one.
Yeah.
All right. Next two comments are from Samuel. The first of Samuel's comments is from May 31st. This is on the chronology. So Samuel says, and this is he left this on episode 243. Samuel says, "Hi, I started listening to your podcast a while ago from the start, and I'm now on episode 91. I really liked this episode since I've been reading the Notion Club papers and was getting bogged down in all the philosophical stuff." So I guess he jumped forward to 243. Mm-hmm. This really helped, and I do hope you take an episode or a few to look more closely at it. I'm reading the entire Middle Earth Legendarium chronologically with the help of Lawrence King's website, chronology.org/Tolkien. You should check it out. It would be great if at some point you did an interview of him. Just an idea.
Hmm.
That's the first time I've heard of Lawrence King, I believe. But definitely I will link to his website and for others to take a look at as well. So and check it out myself.
Yeah.
So thank you, Samuel.
Yes,
and then let's get your other note here. And then Samuel on episode 244 commented, "I just got your two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture, for my birthday, and they're great. Keep up the good podcasting."
Wow.
Thank you so much, Samuel.
That's fantastic.
Really appreciate that. By the way,
happy birthday.
Yes, happy birthday.
Maybe a little belated at this point, but still, happy birthday.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture, both, as of today, are now available on Audible. So you can go, Audible's great. I use it, like, it's basically how I read books now because I'm just too short an attention span at this point to, like, read, to do a lot of visual reading, unless it comes to Tolkien. But I do listen to a lot of audiobooks and I love Audible. And now both of my books are available on Audible, with me reading them. And I actually redid, for those of you who may have heard the recordings that I did in the past, I actually redid the recordings to sound better and to be higher quality.
Mm.
So, hey, you know, another way to support my work here with the Tolkien Road is go over and use your Audible credits or...
He means our work.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
It was the royal
eye. The work of the Tolkien Road.
Yes.
Sorry.
The work. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting, though.
Yeah.
I didn't know you had stuff on Audible.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to remember to link to... the link to them, the Audible recordings in the show notes as well. So,
yeah, you do a lot more of the work, though. I should give you.
Oh, it's all credit. Good. It's all good. I couldn't do it without you.
It's true. It wouldn't be the same.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It would definitely not. And you are a big draw. are a big draw for our audience for sure. Otherwise, like I've said in the past, it's just me blabbing on, and who wants to listen to that?
That was kind of like what today's episode was.
Yeah, kind of.
But yeah, it's okay. We need one of those now and then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Samuel.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Thanks for corresponding, and keep in touch as you continue on your journey.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and our last comment is from the aforementioned Jennifer, and this is a continuation of her Doctor Who comment. So I believe we responded to her earlier Doctor Who comment on a previous episode. She made a passing reference to Doctor Who that I didn't understand, nor did my son, who is a Doctor Who fan. Not a hardcore one, but was into it a couple of years ago. Jennifer replies, "It is based on an in-show joke that has been used since the very first episode from 1963. There is no question mark in the show's title, all caps, but it has been used in various ways throughout the show's history. In New Who, it has been used literally as a question, since the Doctor never tells anyone his real name, with maybe one exception. Within the Doctor Who universe, it is said to be the oldest question in the universe, the question that must never be answered. I never fully understood that last part.
Hmm.
So.
I thought who was his name.
It's the central mystery. Yeah. This is the idea that, you know, on a TV show that once you answer the inciting central mystery of a show, then you've ruined that show, right? Then
you haven't ruined it. You've just completed it.
Well, exactly. But to complete it is to end it, right?
To end it. But by ending thing, you're not necessarily ruining it.
Okay. So the extreme artistic version, some artists might say that, yes, you have killed it at that point, right? Like once you've answered the question, you've killed it.
But all good things must come to an end.
So when they get to the end, if they say, okay, it's time to end this,
mm-hmm.
right? They can either choose to answer the question,
mm-hmm.
right? And I will say, I don't usually find those kinds of answers very satisfactory, right? Or they cannot answer the question and just let it be an open-ended mystery, right?
Did they ever?
And then it survives for spinoffs and future seasons, right?
Oh, that's true. So do you think, did they ever answer the question on Lost? Did they ever?
They tried to, but I remember thinking it just all felt like they didn't, like they had to kind of make it up at the end. Like,
yeah, I guess that's fair. Yeah, they tried to.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know, that the whole concept of endings on TV shows is a very interesting one.
It really is. It absolutely is. We were talking about this the other day about how Bosch is coming out with its final season,
mm-hmm.
right? So that series is going to be ending, right?
Right. So that'll be interesting because I feel like the big mystery there is, it actually answered a big mystery there, but one of like the third or fourth season,
mm-hmm.
I think,
mm-hmm.
Which you may argue is the inciting mystery. But to me, the inciting mystery of that show is just like what makes Bosch so awesome. So.
Exactly. And the answer to that knows no bounds. So.
I mean, it's just who he is, right? Gosh. So there you go.
Yep.
All right. Okay. Jennifer, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for educating us further on the universe of Doctor Who. So, all right. That's it for correspondence, y'all. And that's it for the episode. But we'd love to hear from you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, etc. Wherever you can find us. So that's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Lise Yu,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Johanna T,
Mike M,
Robert H,
Paul D,
and Julia,
as well as those celebrating their patron anniversary in June, Teresa C,
and James L.
Thank you all very much.
Yes, thanks, guys.
And thanks to everyone who is listening. And we will talk at you next time.
And watching. Yeah.
If they're watching, they're listening too.
That's true.
Yeah.
Good point.
But thank you for watching.
Yes. Bye, y'all.
Bye.